Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. We now have a counteroffer from Republicans in the so-called fiscal cliff negotiations. I prefer fiduciary escarpment, but you choose your metaphor. Last week, the GOP called the Obama proposal laughable. Today, the administration is calling the Republican proposal unacceptable. Let's get a conservative take on the two proposals and talk about what wins between laughable and unacceptable with Jim Capretta. He's a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, AEI. Jim, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Very, very glad to be with you this morning.
Sure. Fiscal cliff. Is that what you call it?
Yeah, I do, actually. Just because it seems to be the moniker that everybody recognizes now, so I go with that.
That's right. This is one aspect of language. If we all know what we're talking about, we agree on it. So the Republican offer, it moves away from the big changes to Medicare and Medicaid that were in the Paul Ryan budget, but it also doesn't include any tax increases to the wealthiest 2%. So do you see the budget, this proposal, as a move to the middle or kind of drawing a line in the sand over tax rates? How do you see it?
Well, I think actually the one thing you just said might be inaccurate, that it will be a tax increase on the rich. I mean, I think the question is how do you raise taxes on the rich, not if you raise taxes on the rich.
Right.
I think the Republican offer concedes that they would raise, I think, $800 billion over a decade, which to me seems like an awful lot of money. That's a big tax increase.
But it wouldn't be changing, just to be clear, it wouldn't be changing the rates. Raising the rates. Okay.
They're suggesting to do it the way Erskine Bowles, who was one of the co-chairs of the Bowles-Simpson Commission that the president appointed, he suggested you do a revenue raising exercise that would hit mainly people on the upper end of the income scale by doing a tax reform program. That is, under their proposal, you'd lower the rates even for the very top bracket. Broaden the base very substantially and raise revenue as a net total. So I think this is a question of whether or not one thinks higher marginal rates is really the way to try to go about this, or whether or not go back to where the president was, frankly, in the summer of 2011, where he was for tax reform, broadening the base, raising revenue that way. It's only really been since he went through the election campaign that he's become insistent on raising the top marginal rate.
And Erskine Bowles has said of this plan, it's not his plan. You know, he says he's flattered that they'd cite me and call it the Bowles plan. It's not my approach. Why is, to your way of thinking, raising tax revenue by closing loopholes or other means preferable to simply raising the rate? Really, and we're talking about raising the rate only a few percentage point to the highest income earners.
Well, I mean, I think the argument is whether, you know, which one is better for the economy. I mean, I think that was really what this comes down to. And there's been a bipartisan consensus that goes back about 20 years that says the best kind of tax code is actually not one with lots of different, marginal rates, but actually one with two or three rate brackets, a much broader base, and a closing of, you know, special exemptions that really affect people on the upper end more than other people. For instance, you could alter the tax treatment of health insurance, frankly, for people on the very upper end of the income scale. They don't need a tax subsidy to get their health insurance, but they do get one. And the higher the marginal rate, the more it's worth to them. So if one were to do a tax reform and this is the biggest tax expenditure in the entire budget, if you did a tax reform where upper income people no longer could take advantage of that tax break, you would have beneficial effects in terms of revenue, but you also have beneficial effects in terms of the functioning of the health system, where people on their upper end would have much more cost sensitivity to their health insurance, which would be a good thing.
Do you favor a cap on total amount of deductions? Is that a policy that you think would be helpful?
You know, I'm not sure I would go that route myself, actually. I think I'd probably pick the tax expenditures that are most deserving of being scaled back and target them, especially for people in the upper end of the income scale. So I already mentioned one, which is there's a very large tax preference for health insurance. Frankly, I'd also target the housing tax preferences that are applicable to people on the upper end of the income scale. Especially, I don't see much use in allowing people to have a mortgage interest deduction on multiple homes, which obviously primarily affects well-to-do people. The other aspect is, and this is something I think would be sensitive for people in your community in New York, but it's not at all clear to me why the federal government subsidizes more expensive state and local governance through an open-ended federal tax break for that as well. That favors obviously very high, high and expensive state governments at the expense of states where they don't have as expensive state government.
Right. It's it's mostly the blue states, to be clear, to be kind of blunt and perhaps oversimplify, where there's higher state and local tax rates and those are deductible. And so that's a deduction that actually is not a progressive deduction. But I just want to ask you about the politics of this proposal, because people have looked at it and they said it's pretty similar to what Speaker Boehner offered Obama in a closed-door negotiation in the summer of 2011. The president didn't like that then. Why do you think this moves the ball for them now?
Actually, I don't think that's a fair recounting of the history. If you recall, they were actually very close to striking a deal around an $800 million tax increase that had this change in the entitlement programs, namely a change in how the Social Security indexing would work, and some changes around Medicare, including the president agreeing to raising the eligibility age in Medicare. So the idea that this was rejected by President Obama out of hand is actually just not true. President Obama was agreed to it initially, and then later backed out when he wanted to raise taxes even more because he found out about another deal that was being offered that would have raised even more revenue. So, all of this has been recounted in multiple stories about what happened. So the idea that this is out of line with where President Obama would have been in 2011 is actually not true.
Mike Pesca in for Brian Lehrer on NPR, speaking with Jim Capretta. He's a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, visiting fellow at AEI, talking about the new proposal that the Republicans have said, fine, you want something, here's something, we'll put this on the table. This proposal talks about closing special interest loopholes and deductions. Jim and I were talking about what some of them would be. But to be clear, this is ideas that you think are good. A few of them are ideas that I've heard many conservative economists saying, yes, this is the sort of deduction we should close. But none of these are mentioned in the proposal. The proposal is very vague. Do you think that's a good thing or a necessary thing to get these negotiations rolling?
I do, actually. Candidly, I find it unlikely that the Congress would be able to pass the full-blown deal before the end of the year. What's needed at this point is some kind of agreement in principle that allows us to delay going over the fiscal cliff come January 1, and then allows time for the committees of jurisdiction in the Congress, both the House and Senate, to actually draft up reasonable structural proposals to accomplish the goals that are agreed to. There still will be a lot of pressure. I'm sure they'll have a trigger mechanism in this agreement to force them to act on those proposals next year. But the idea that you're going to get an entitlement reform done as well as a tax reform done all before January 1, I think is too ambitious. And I think rushing it would end up very likely leading to a bad outcome. So what they need to do, and I think the president's agreeable to this, is to agree how they're going to get this done, push the fiscal cliff items off so that they don't trigger January 1, and then give the Congress time to work with the president toward a final agreement early next year.
When a deal finally does get done, and maybe it'll be in 2013, do you predict that it will include rate increases and not just revenue increases, rate increases on the wealthiest 2%, say?
I think it could very well. Absolutely. I do think that's a real possibility. Frankly, if I were the Republicans, I'd say, fine, Mr. President, you really are absolutely committed to raising taxes on rich people. I would give the president a millionaire's surtax or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I would not give him, though, a rate increase on everybody above $200,000 a year in income or $250,000 a year in income, because, candidly, I think it'll hurt growth. There's a lot of people in that category, and they're not all considered rich, especially people listening to your radio station in the New York City area. So the idea that somehow that's a punitive thing that's going to tax people that have a lot of discretionary income, I just think isn't true. I think it will hurt the economy. I would give the president, if he's absolutely committed to raising taxes on rich people, I would actually give him a tax that hits rich people,
yeah.
Something like a millionaire's surtax.
And as an economist, are you an economist?
I'm not a PhD economist, no. I've worked in government service for a little over 15 years. I'm a public policy analyst.
So as an expert, we could say, what's the point where a tax on a certain income level doesn't hurt the economy? Like you said, a tax on people or couples earning $250,000 would. Do you think a tax on millionaires wouldn't hurt the economy at that point?
Well, look, there's big disagreements about this among economists, you know, so I don't think one could definitively say one way or the other. You're going to get people on both sides of this kind of a question. From my own reading of the situation, my own judgment is that having lower marginal rates are, in general, always better than higher marginal rates because they provide a better incentive for savings, investment, and work. Those are what drive the economy. Now, you can't have lower marginal rates so low that you have huge budget deficits.
Right.
Well, obviously, there's a question of balance here. What kind of marginal rates are necessary to have sound fiscal policy consistent with having the lowest marginal rates possible to promote growth? That's the question.
And do you think
For me, I would say that something at this point in our political history, given especially where how the president conducted the campaign, I would go ahead and just do some kind of millionaire surtax. I do think it might have some marginally damaging effect in the economy, but not enough to overcome, you know, the fact that there seems to be a political interest in doing this.
And aside from political interest, do you buy at all the argument that's put forth that there's a fairness aspect to it, a statement that is the right statement that the government should be made about taxing billionaires at a somewhat higher rate?
Well, obviously, I believe in a progressive tax code. We have a massively, massively progressive tax code already. The question is, does it need to be even more progressive? So I think the president, you know, my own judgment about this, and I'm sure many of your listeners disagree, but my own judgment is the president is way, way over the top in terms of making this argument as being central to our economic history and future. The idea of redistributing money more and more from millionaires and billionaires as being an aid to the economy is just not true. It may help marginally raise some revenue for the federal government. That is not at all what's central to promoting long-term economic growth, which is really what's critical for middle-class families. So I think it's a distraction. I don't think it has much value at all. But the president won re-election, and he really, really wants to tax the rich people.
Yeah.
So I would go ahead and allow him to, you know, impose a millionaire surtax.
And this is all true. This all stands, even though the difference, what we're talking about, is a difference of a 35% tax versus a 39.5% tax. It only seems like 4.5%. If I'm making $1 million, I guess that's, what, $45,000, so that ain't nothing. But everything you're saying, you know, we're not talking about going from very small taxes to going to very huge taxes. We're talking about a 4.5% raise in taxes. That's what the president is proposing.
Well, on the other hand, you have to understand, first of all, he's not proposing that. He's proposing going from 35 to 39.6 on everybody above $250,000 a year and $200,000 a year, not $1 million. So it's not just rich people, so to speak. It's going to be upper middle class people in a lot of communities, people with two incomes. Moreover, you have to understand that the health care law has already raised marginal rates on these people very substantially, essentially added a 4.7% tax on all income above $250,000 a year currently. So if you add another 4.6, you're talking about, well, what are you talking about, 9.3, right? So
right.
That's a pretty big tax increase.
Right. And I think I even misspoke when I gave my example. I'm realizing because if taxes were to increase by 4.5% on people earning over $200,000, that those taxes only kick in at the $200,000 point. Anyway, let's move on beyond the math because I really want to get to entitlements. And it seems like if Republicans have this proposal where they're not being very specific about what the loopholes and deductions are that they're targeting, you know, you could say the same thing that Democrats aren't really talking about Social Security at all. The Obama plan doesn't touch Social Security, whereas the Republican plan calls for changing the way benefit increases are calculated. Do you worry that including changes to a program that Democrats – do you worry about including changes to a program, Social Security, that Democrats are saying are off the table? Could that queer the whole deal?
Well, I mean, I think at this point it's quite clear that Republicans are – going to have a very divisive question on their side, which is revenue increases, right? So there's going to be a lot of committed members of the Republican Party say, you know what, the issue with the federal budget isn't revenue, it's spending.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, I have great sympathy with that, because I do think that that's largely the case. But they're willing to give up revenue at this point to come to some kind of a bipartisan agreement. You can't, neither side can get its way. So the extent that Democrats are saying as part of the negotiation, absolutely not, this is off the table, we'll never, ever, ever do anything, I think that's, you know, I don't think that's fair. I think that's not bargaining in good faith. And candidly, the president has talked up, and many Democrats have talked up for 2 years now, the Bowles-Simpson approach as being the way toward a bipartisan solution. And they touch Social Security, and they touch Medicare. And so, I think, you know, Democrats that are talking that way are probably, you know, the ones who are most likely to hold up a deal and push us over the cliff.
I asked you before if you thought that whenever a deal was made, if rates would increase. I'll ask you the same question about Social Security. When you think a deal is eventually made, do you think Social Security will be touched?
To the extent that they do this thing called a chained CPI correction, yes. I think that's probably likely to be part of the deal.
What is that?
That means that they're going to change how they're measuring inflation,
right?
Which in a way that they believe is actually more accurate, and I agree, a more accurate measure of actual inflation. When you do that, it actually will tend to be a lower inflation update for Social Security benefits on an annual basis, and you will save some money. So yeah, to the extent that you consider that a change in Social Security, then yes, I do believe that will be part of a final deal if there is a deal.
What about the age when you could get either Social Security or Medicare benefits? Might that change?
I do think the Medicare age is definitely on the table and could very well be part of the deal, yes. Social Security, no. I think it's already on schedule to go up to 67, so it's likely to remain there. But the Medicare change going to age 67 could easily happen.
Medicare change, how significant will that be, you know, pushing it up to that age?
Well, it's significant in the sense that it reduces the long-term unfunded liabilities of the program by a fair amount. So in a sense, that's a positive from my point of view. You have to understand that Medicare, when it was created in 1965, since then the longevity of people on the program has gone up very, very dramatically, both men and women. And so we have people that are on the program a lot longer than even were anticipated at the time of enactment. So you have to adjust how these retirement programs work with time and with reality and demographics. Otherwise, they become unstable, which is what exactly has happened with both programs.
I was reading a column by Robert Samuelson, and he makes the point, and he has, I think, in every column, the main thing government spends money on, and you might not realize this, dear reader, but the main thing that our government spends money on is funding retirees. And we have to reform that if we're ever going to come into some sort of fiscal sanity. You know, at the bottom line, are we ever going to get our fiscal house in order if we don't in some way reduce the benefits that people expect under Social Security, Medicare?
No, we won't. So it's a question of how to do it in a way that makes sense, in a way to do it that's, you know, sensible and allow people to adjust over time. You have to understand that if you look around the world, I mean, this is the problem with so many major institutions, including big governments, right? If you think about state and local governments that are teetering on the abyss for collapse, it's because they have excessive retiree commitments in pensions and health care. Same with the auto industry, the airline industry, the steel industry, European governments, you know. So this is sweeping the world in terms of a huge problem, how to downsize your obligations so that the institution itself remains viable and dynamic, and the federal government is facing the same problem. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to go to zero. Absolutely, we're going to be protecting people who need, you know, help in retirement and help with their health care and help with their pensions. The question is the way to do it in a way that is affordable for the government and for the taxpayer and consistent with a pro-growth environment. And that's what we're grappling with. And so, you know, I don't think it's all going to be solved in this fiscal deal. It's going to be a number of years before that's resolved entirely.
And my last question is a political one. You've seen a lot of negotiations. This Boehner proposal has been called unacceptable. The Obama proposal was called laughable. But do you think the latest proposal, the Boehner proposal, actually moves things along a little bit?
I think it moves it well down the road toward an agreement. I do think that the president is, you know, when with these kind of negotiations, the idea of treating everything that comes out of a negotiator's mouth as totally serious and something that is, you know, shows that the negotiations are going well or poorly is not really a good way to view it. I mean, there's going to be a process that has to be gone through with both sides doing a fair amount of huffing and puffing
yes.
before they get to an agreement. And we're only at December 4th, and the cliff is January 1. So as you can imagine, there'll be a few more rounds of this before they get to the end game.
It is a dance, and the choreography is recognizable. Jim Capretta, fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and the American Enterprise Institute, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And from the, okay, let's say it's cesspool in Washington to the sewage from Sandy, back in a moment talking about that.